Hello and welcome to another edition of the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. Coming up in the next half hour, a singer's journey along the Blackwater, composing electronic music the open source way and finding the sounds of ancient poetry. But we begin with a bit of a cavort. Kristen Fontanella's dancing story began in the sharp elbow world of Irish competitive dancing in the US. Success there led, as it sometimes did, to her involvement with the juggernauts of Irish dancing, such as Riverdance and Gaelforce, that once created unlikely international audiences for Irish dance. Fontanella weaned herself off that scene and began to create her own blend of Irish and contemporary dance. As her latest show, In Limbo, laces up for a national tour, Kristen Fontanella talked to Culturefile about straight leg leaps, TikTok tutorials, and the joy of the dance floor.
I'm Kristen Fontanella. I'm originally from Connecticut in the States, and now I live over here in County Galway. I'm a choreographer and dance artist, and I work between the mediums of traditional and contemporary dance. So when I was young, my mother put me into a dance school, the Griffith Academy in Wethersfield, Connecticut. And there they taught tap, jazz, ballet, the normal routine, but they also had Irish step dancing. So from the age of 6, I started Irish step dancing, and it's a competitive dance form. Every weekend we'd go to a fesh and compete, and I was pretty good, so I would win, so that would keep me going and get medals and this, that, and the other. And as I progressed through all the levels, I ended up going to regionals. Next step was nationals, and then on to worlds. So this was all during the 80s and 90s, so our one trip over to worlds, it was in Ennis, I believe in 96 or 97, and that was my first experience in Ireland. To do the World Championships, dance on that stage.
I was actually there, I think.
Were you?
I remember they had set up downstairs the stalls and I tried to take photographs and I was nearly mauled.
You cannot take photos. No. No, there's no videoing of the competition. It's a funny rule of, you know, no one wants to steal someone else's steps. But now with social media, it's kind of...
Did that change then?
It's evolved a bit. Still can't record competitions, but now steps and techniques are being shared, you know, from the studios. The kids now can do amazing technique. They levitate off the floor. So it's evolved in the sense, like, I can give an example. When I learned a leap, I learned it with a bent leg. It then evolved through my time to a straight leg. Now it's with the straight leg, but they are... It's like they have hang time, like they're these NBA professional basketball players. They hang in the air for like what seems like minutes.
And does that just come from pure leg strength, is it?
Oh, yeah. I get in good debates with people. I always say Irish dancing is a sport because these dancers are extreme athletes and have to train not only in the dance form itself, but they're in the gym, they're lifting, they're conditioning. It takes a full fit body to do it.
I see a lot of dance instructions on TikTok. Is Irish dance there too? I haven't seen it so far.
I have seen a dance company called Fusion Fighters on TikTok. It's a nice, fun way for Irish dancers to explore maybe different movements, which I'm always up for because that's my whole ethos.
You work in what we'd call traditional dance, but maybe that's not the best definition for what you do, though.
I like to say I take what I know from my traditional dance training because I've been doing that for over... 30 years. I take that traditional training and I use it in a contemporary context. So what that means is Irish dancing's in my blood. It's in my feet. It will never go away, but I use it in a more grounded, released, and loose way. So with the show that I have now and all my works, it's in bare feet. The dancers, they are all traditionally trained, but they're open-minded. They're open to other ways of moving. So we really use the ground. We still use rhythm, but it's not with the hard shoes that you're used to seeing. It's with bare feet. It's with the percussion of the body or the movement of the entire body, not just the feet. In Limbo started research and development, I believe, in 2016. It has become a full 50-minute piece with 6 dancers and 4 musicians. And it just explores the world between tradition and contemporary. Without myself knowing it while developing it, actually almost a autobiography of my life as a professional Irish dancer. So I didn't realize this until I had my dramaturg, Jonathan Tweedy, point it out to me. The show starts with dancers lined at the back of the stage and their backs are to the audience. And you're there for almost an uncomfortable amount of time with nothing happening. And then slowly one dancer steps out of line. And I didn't realize this, but I'm like, oh, that was me. That was me deciding to leave the professional dance world and start creating my own. So that symbol of her stepping out of line was me making that choice in my life. In Limbo really was, I didn't know where I fit. So I didn't know if I should tick the box of a traditional artist or tick the box of a contemporary dancer. I felt like I was in the middle and I was annoyed. I'm like, why are there these boxes? I don't want to, I can't fit in any of them. So I literally felt in limbo. I felt in between. I didn't know where I belonged. So I wanted to make this world where all these other people who didn't know where they wanted to belong, all these misfits, like, come and dance with me and we'll find where we belong. So it's really, we're inviting the audience into our world and then we leave them because we're happy with where we are. So the ending scenes are these joyous moments where the dancers are actually looking at each other, seeing that it coming out of each all of them, and they're in this circle, and it's a very repetitive circle, but you find this freedom and this release. So the competitive aspect of Irish dancing is just one small section of it. There's multiple avenues to go down, and the joy in finding the it is, it's a beautiful moment, and I don't know, I just invite you on the dance floor to feel or to know what that means. It's a beautiful moment.
Kristen Fontanella there, and her show In Limbo begins its national tour in Roscommon Arts Centre on January 30th, followed by dates across the country before opening at Project in Dublin on February 13th. KristenFontanella.com for more. One of the many treats for visitors at the recent Music Minds Festival in Doolin were sessions by composer and programmer Kerry Hagen. Hagen ran what she calls a patching circle for the music software Pure Data, an open source tool that aims to let composers use sophisticated electronics in their work without calling tech support. Hagen, who's now based in UL, previously worked with the inventor of Pure Data, Miller Puckett, with whom she also makes music. Culture Files' Louise McMahon and talk to her about Pure Data, patching, and her recent Shannon-influenced orchestral work with the RTE NSO's Composer Lab.
I'm actually a classically trained composer. I went to study for my PhD at the University of California, San Diego, in composition. While I was there, for a variety of really boring reasons, I ended up being a research assistant for Miller Puckett, who was at that point just a year or two into developing PD. And so as his research assistant, it was the first programming language for music that I ever learned, and it was in its infancy as well, to an extent. And so you could say it's not only my native language, but I grew up with it.
PD, all programming happens in a flow from top to bottom.
Pure Data, or PD, is a graphical programming environment that was designed to allow composers to be able to program digital audio signal processing without needing the expertise of technicians. It allows composers to do more with computer music without needing additional expertise than they used to be able to do back when the roles in computer music were more divided between composer, artist, technician, producer.
Imagine composers in the 80s, what they were used to doing was going into a studio where every box had a different function, and you got your sound by patching from one box to another, to another, to another. And that's why the Pure Data program is called a patch.
I tend to be highly organized when I am composing a new work, but it's not always in the same way with every work. Sometimes I'm inspired by a single sound I hear in my head, and so I start working with that sound and then go out from there. So it might be a single cell, a musical fragment, a timbre. A lot of the music I make with computers is generative, in the sense that there's some kind of process that's generating the music, and then based on that process, it can be indefinite or it could be fixed in time. I am in a duo with Miller Puckett, and we do a variety of things, from installation work to performance work. And at least one installation that we've installed in more than one place is called Remnant, and it's generative. Remnant was commissioned by Mise en Place Bushwick, which is an affiliate of the Mise en Ensemble in New York, in Brooklyn. We recorded instrumentalists walking through the rehearsal space while sending blasts of white noise into the space. And what we got were the acoustic shadows and acoustic reflections of these performers. We then used those shadows and reflections as filters in the way that your body is currently filtering the sounds I'm making. It's absorbing some of them, it's bouncing other ones. So someone sitting next to you would hear me differently than someone sitting next to me, because your body is changing my sound. So we recorded a few of the musicians through the space, through the performance space, and then used those as filters. And then we recorded them making music that I'd written for them. And the installation itself is random combinations of them playing instrumental parts filtered through themselves or through someone else or in some way. And what you get are these eerie, filtered snippets of music coming, and it's of course multi-channel, so that means it comes from all different places, hidden underneath benches, in cupboards. We installed that same one at the Beast Feast in Birmingham, and it was a completely different space, but the idea was that we're taking the bodies and the remnants of these performers from this dedicated space in Brooklyn, and we're transplanting it into other spaces. Limerick is my home, and the Shannon River goes through Limerick, and it goes through my workplace, the University of Limerick, and I'm very attached to my home. And so it just was just there, very, very present for me when the opportunity came up, and I thought, I want to take recordings from up and down the Shannon River, but rather than hearing the water, I want those recordings to be processed and become the electronic sounds that are part of the orchestra piece. I didn't want water rushing through. I didn't want the beach crashing and so on. So they're all there, but they're heavily processed to either have pitches or to be like other instruments. And once I had that list of sounds and what I wanted to do with them, then the orchestra piece was about going back and forth between blending instrumental sounds, the way you'd expect to hear the instruments, with the noise sounds and the things that the water was capable of sounding like. Very few of my works for electronics aren't live. In the case of the orchestral work, I really wanted the electronics to be just another instrument in the orchestra. I didn't want it to be for orchestra and electronics, right? So I had two graduate students at the time, trained, classically trained musicians who were also studying with me at UL, and they learned the electronics part. The day of the live performance, they were there performing the electronics part by clicking the right buttons at the right time, following the conductor. It was definitely live.
Kerry Hagen there talking to Louise McMahon, and Dr. Hagen and her students will host a series of surprise Pure Data pop-ups in Limerick throughout 2020. If you fancy performing your drama of Irish pub culture in an Irish pub, try not to be too successful. Broken Crow Theatre Company's Blackwater Babble, which celebrates, among other things, the pub's sing-song, had its premiere in Callanan's Pub in George's Quay in Cork City back in 2018. But now the mystical two-hander starring John McCarthy and Gary Murphy returns for a nationwide tour, having been coaxed out of the snug and onto the stage of theatres around the country. Culture Files' Rachel Andrews went to meet the cast and director Joe Marr to talk about scaling up and singing out.
The Irish pub in itself is a very particular thing. You know, it's something that's... I remember some years ago when they were doing surveys on why people come to Ireland, and at the same time bringing in the smoking ban and pubs were closing down, but then realising that people's number one reason for coming to Ireland is actually the Irish pub and Irish music in the pub and the sing-song.
The joys of the labouring man.
My name is Joe Marr. I'm the director of Blackwater Babble.
Boozing, bloody well boozing.
Ronan the writer always envisioned it being in a pub because a large part of the play is about one of the characters in his younger days was attempting to write a book about the evolution of a pub sing-song and how it works and how it fails when it fails and those sort of things. So the idea of having it, having the show itself in a pub where people have their pint in their hand and watch the show was very interesting and evocative to him. It relies on intimacy, and it's more difficult to be intimate with someone in a 200-seater theatre or whatever. So it's a matter of a bit of voice work with the lads, being clear on what needs to be different from the last time and what can remain the same.
Thought you didn't remember.
I thought you did.
Locks the door. Pours himself a drink. And the sing-song begins!
Even though there's two of us on the stage, we're both playing the same person at different stages in his life. And as far as I'm concerned, as an actor, I'm the only person on the stage. I never refer to John, I never see John, I never engage with John, even though I'm talking to John for the whole play.
I think it's David Mamet, who I don't really like, but I think David Mamet said all dialogue is interrupted monologue. So I have the thing I want to say, but I need him sometimes to feed me things in order to say it.
Tell me, says he!
Stop!
Well, I know she has a bit of a reputation.
Shut up!
It's along the Blackwater River that he used to spend, you know, these summers or whenever he went off doing this, and it was in the pubs along the Blackwater that he heard these sing-songs, and the characters who can bring a sing-song alive and the ones who can kill it with two notes because they should never be singing publicly. You know.
Boozing, bloody well boozing. Comes home on a Saturday, gives his wife all she goes off to the market, makes many a call.
The place of it is important. Some of the places along the river are referred to. Ronan Fitzgibbon, the writer, who is a Cork man but lives in Tramore in Waterford, I'd imagine a lot of the imagery from this came from driving up and down to Cork, and could you cross over to Blackwater a couple of times in doing so? And there's lovely little villages along the way, like Capoquin, for example, that we mentioned.
What brings her home clinging onto the wall?
So I guess the Blackwater is what winds in between that, and I guess the river is almost a metaphor for the memory drifting away eventually into the ocean, which is death, if you like, beyond us.
And it's all of us likes to go boozing. Thank you. I never knew you had it in you.
Actors John McCarthy and Gary Murphy and director Joe Marr there on their show Blackwater Babble, which tonight is in Ballyduff Upper in Waterford, tomorrow reaches the Schoolyard Theatre Charleville, then on to Tallaght and Kilkenny before ending its tour at Garter Lane, Waterford on the 1st of February. At Broken Crow TC for more details. And finally, this time on the Culture File Weekly, quick question. Is it rude to refer to languages as dead when they might simply be taking a very long nap? The process of gently rousing lost languages is at the heart of Old English specialist Alice Jorgensen's work at the School of English at TCD. Culture File's Eleanor Flegg brought her microphone to meet Professor Jorgensen and capture the sound of the living dead.
My name is Alice Jorgensen. I'm a lecturer in English at Trinity College Dublin. I've often found with my students that they're particularly fascinated by hearing me try to read aloud the text that I teach them, so that they get this kind of echo of a living language rather than simply a set of exercises on a page. I think it's also particularly valuable because many of these languages, although they are no longer heard, were languages that existed in a very strongly oral culture. So the literatures that we're studying, in fact, were designed to be heard. The parts of it that's being written down is probably a very small amount of what was originally there. And they have all this sound patterning, patterns in Old English of alliteration, patterns of weight of different syllables are also important to poetic structure. So it's in fact very important to think about those sounds and the effects that they produced if we want to study the texts and resurrect some voices that have fallen silent. I'm going to read a very short poem from the Exeter Book of Old English Poetry, which was copied in the 960s or 970s. So this is a poem in a woman's voice talking possibly, though it's a very enigmatic poem, about her lover who is an enemy of her people and her son who is referred to as a whelp who is being taken away to the woods. Leodomis minum swilchehim mon lark yifa. Weleth hi hinna arthur jan ye feon threat gumeth unye likesus. It is to my people as if someone would give them a gift. They will consume him if he comes into their troop. It is different with us. Wolf is on one island, I on another. That island is secure, surrounded by fen. There are bloodthirsty men on the island. They will consume him if he comes into their troop. It is different with us. I pursued in my hopes the far journeys of Wolf, when it was rainy weather, and I sat sorrowful. Then the battle-bold one laid his arms around me. There was joy to me in that, yet it was also hateful to me. Wolf, my hopes of you have made me sick. Your rare visits, a mourning mind, and this is not at all from lack of food. Do you hear me, Erdwaka? The wolf bears are wretched whelp to the woods. That may easily be separated, which was never bound, the riddle of us two together. It's a very puzzling poem, and one of the things about it, I mean, it's known as Wolf and Erdwaka, but that's just because those names appear in the poem. One of the things about it is that the emotions communicate themselves so strongly, and yet what the story actually is very greatly debated. So there is an interpretation, perhaps a rather comical one, not very widely held, is that they are actually dogs and that the baby is referred to as a whelp because it is a whelp. So that kind of riddling, strange interpretation could be supported from that point of view. But it seems so passionate and so recognisable, even though we don't know what the story is. Wolf, mean wolf, when mi thina selka you did done, thina seld kumas, murnendam od nalas metalista. Ye hear us through Erdwaka, unkern ermna whelp birith wolf to wuda. For me, one of the things that awakened my fascination with Old English was hearing Old English read aloud, and that was by my father. So my parents had a certain amount of material around, and my dad would occasionally read it aloud, which is something he did very well. So the magic of the sound of it was something that I got to before actually ever trying to read it. I'm very aware that when I read a poem like this, I'm still reading it in a way with my own accent. But we can work things out to a surprising degree since the 19th century in particular, scholars have painstakingly worked out the processes by which sounds change in languages. And that means that you can project backwards. And it also means that you can take the evidence of how things were spelt and how they are spelt in various different languages and compare them. A thing about English specifically is that we're very used to a situation in which English spelling is not a particularly good guide to English pronunciation, but that is actually a result very largely of changes that have happened, I was going to say quite recently, but in the last 500 years. But that is quite recent when you work on Old English. So it's a complex. You look at the way things are written, you look at the way things change, you deduce the rules by which languages have developed from each other and compare with each other. And through that, you can reconstruct a system of sounds operating in the language. And then you can do your best to read those sounds aloud. But it's always going to be a little approximate. I can't actually go and listen to a real Anglo-Saxon and get the precise flavour of how they pronounce the vowel eh. You know, was it eh? Was it eh? There's some subtle differences that we can't get back to.
I'm noticing that you don't use the phrase dead languages.
I'm not sure languages die. Interest in languages can die. This is a language that for me is, although it's not a language anybody speaks anymore routinely, it's still got things to say to me, things that I find very deeply moving or insightful or just curious and worth puzzling out. Also, I suppose dead language tends to be used in a dismissive and derogatory way. I want to show people that what we're doing is worth it, can open doors in the imagination, and that it's not just some sort of inert and crumbling dusty thing.
New mon ik heima, new I vid vir, mjod vid marnen, fir mon nedan.
Alice Jorgensen there on Speaking the Unspoken. And you heard also the voices of Tanaya Jorgensen, Old Norse specialist, and Jürgen Ehrlich, a specialist in early Irish. And that brings us to the end of the Culture File Weekly for this week. We'll be back with more quixotic phonemes at 7 p.m. next Friday here on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.